Hello and welcome to Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Merger Market. I'm Juliana Needham. In this episode, we're heading to the US to find out how recent changes in SEC regulations are reshaping capital markets. The SEC is in many ways going back to basics under the current administration by focusing on investor harm, looking to simplify the IPO process, and it's also considering switching to semi-annual rather than quarterly reporting for public companies. In this conversation, Merger Market's Troy Hooper, co-head of Equity Capital Markets for the Americas, spoke to Eddie Best, a partner at Wilkie. Eddie is a member of the Corporate and Financial Services team and co-chair of the Capital Markets Practice.
Yeah, hi, Eddie. Thanks for joining us on Dealcast. I was wondering if we could just start with a brief introduction of yourself and a brief synopsis of your career.
Sure. I'm a Midwesterner by birth, went to school in Illinois, both undergrad and law school, went directly to a law firm out of law school, practiced there for close to 40 years and was the head of the capital markets group for a number of years at the end. And about 18 months ago, I moved over with a group of colleagues to Wilkie, Farr & Gallagher in Chicago and some of their other offices. And I co-head their capital markets group right now.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure you've seen a lot of changes over your career, but let's maybe start more recently. In the past 15 months, we've seen some changes at the SEC, haven't we?
We sure have. Not surprising, given that there is a Republican administration and things tend to go back and forth depending on whether you've got a Republican or Democratic administration. So under the new SEC administration, the new chairman of the SEC came in and had an agenda to kind of get back to basics, meaning trying to protect investors and trying to assist the capital markets. And so by that, I mean, for example, protecting investors. The prior administration at the SEC had often gone against companies for violation of SEC rules, where perhaps maybe there weren't people that were investors weren't harmed. A great example is there were billions of dollars of settlements by some of the major banks for using texting when they were communicating amongst themselves and with clients. And as you know, texting isn't backed up, and under SEC rules, broker dealers have to be able to access all of the communication. So the SEC went after a number of the large banks, commercial banks, investment banks particularly, and got billions of dollars of settlements, but there was never any allegation that an investor was harmed. So under the new administration, they're going to be looking at investor harm. Where have people been harmed, not just technical SEC violations? And then the other side of the coin is also helping investors, helping the capital markets work more efficiently. We've seen a significant decrease in the number of public companies in the United States over the last 20 years. Part of the reason for that is M&A activity, as one company gobbles up another one. But a lot of that is also companies looking at the high cost of being a public reporting company, both in terms of dollar value and as well as other kinds of things. And the SEC is now looking at ways to make the IPO process easier, the process of being a public company easier and less expensive, and really helping capital formation also by private companies, public companies. We've seen the administration now working on crypto and things like that to try to help them raise capital, not just put roadblocks in front of them.
Great. And one of the major proposals that I've heard is allowing public companies to move from quarterly reporting to semi-annual reporting. Can you talk about that? What are the pros and cons of that proposal?
So that has definitely been on people's agenda for a very long time. As I think you may know, a lot of companies outside the U.S. report on an interim basis, on a six-month basis, rather than on a quarterly basis. The U.S. companies have been reporting on a quarterly basis for decades and decades, but we're a little out of touch with the rest of the world. Now, the pro for companies is there's a lot less reporting. It's going to be cheaper if you only have to report twice a year than four times a year. Also, it will allow companies to focus on long-term goals rather than short-termism. So you don't need to necessarily worry about what's going to happen this quarter. I'm going to worry about what's going to happen for a six-month period. That gives me a little bit longer time frame. But it also allows companies to say, well, that was just one six-month period. We're going to look at it on a yearly or a multiple-year basis. So a lot of people think that that's going to be particularly helpful. It'll also reduce some pressure to provide guidance because people tend to give guidance on a quarterly basis. Here, maybe people are just going to give it on an annual basis rather than a 6 months. For the market, it's going to be a little bit easier to align ourselves with longer duration capital, right? So if you're investing over the long term, do you really need to be looking at a company's quarterly results? It will make companies more competitive with companies in other countries. So from a just performance standpoint, hopefully the reduced burden and the reduced cost will make them more competitive. On the other side, there are some downsides. The concerns for investors primarily are they'll be at an informational disadvantage. There just isn't going to be as much information out there. There'll be some insider information asymmetry where insiders are going to obviously have a lot more information, which is going to put some pressure on insiders and their ability to buy and sell under Rule 10b5, where you know you can't trade on inside information. There'll also be some concern that it's going to harm retail investors because retail investors need a little bit more information and have less access to other kinds of information, whereas institutional investors will have access to all of that information. And of course, then there's also the concerns from the SEC standpoint, which is quarterly reporting makes sure that you're getting information out there on a regular basis. It's looked at by your external auditors, even if it's not audited on a quarterly basis. Your external counsel are looking at it. So there's more information coming out. And so people are less inclined to play those numbers or to hide things. And so there's some concern that there just may be a little bit more fraud as you can hide it for a little bit longer.
Do you think it'll be effective? Do you think this will bring new issuers to the market?
I think it will certainly be helpful. I think some issuers will look at that and certainly understand that it's going to be cheaper. I will tell you, we're you know, getting into the crunch now with most companies having filed their 10Ks, but smaller companies still filing their 10Ks, but already talking about working on their 10Qs. So you've got some smaller companies, you know, working mightily to get their 10Ks filed by the end of March, but then as soon as March 31 rolls around, they've just finished their quarter and they're starting on their 10Q. So it really does detract from management's time on a quarterly basis. So I think management's going to really like that. I think the SEC seems to be favorably inclined towards that. And we'll see whether the institutional investors really rally behind it or rally to oppose it. But I think there's a decent chance it might go through. Now, having said all that, just because the SEC says it's no longer required to report on a quarterly basis doesn't mean some companies might not continue to do it because it presumably will still be voluntary. And also there will be some companies that will be either inclined to or pushed to report some quarterly information, even if it's not a full 10Q, but maybe file an 8K or put out a press release with some quarterly information to, again, help investors. And they may see that as a positive to their stock price. So it'll be an interesting thing to see what the market moves to.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, regulations certainly do present their challenges in the finance sector, but the bigger market concerns right now seem to be the war in Iran, new inputs to the ongoing inflationary pressures, and just geopolitics at large. Can you talk about how that's impacting equity capital markets?
Sure. It's impacting all capital markets, not just equity capital markets, and it's impacting the markets not just in the US, but also abroad. So as I think you know, the markets like stability. Traders probably like some volatility because they make money when things go up or they go down. But the markets generally like stability. And issuers, when they're looking to come to market, are also looking for stability. So, for example, with what's going on in Iran, for example, we've had just in the last week or so, we've had a number of times where a market window opened up because the president announced that it looked like there were ongoing talks. And then, so for example, Monday was a positive day in the marketplace. A number of deals got done on Monday. When the Iranians came out later in the day and said that that wasn't really true, the markets got a little bit spooked. So, you know, Tuesday, maybe less of an open window. Last week, we saw the same thing as companies were looking to come to market, a lot of volatility and a lot of companies decided to stand down. So in general, the markets don't like volatility, though I will say that if you look, I've been doing this, unfortunately, I guess I'll have to admit, close to 40 years. And in that time, I would tell you that volatility like this, a war, geopolitical concerns, what was going on in Ukraine, certainly inflationary pressures, could close down a marketplace for a fairly long period of time. 2008, the capital markets were closed for months. So we've seen extended periods of time where the markets were closed because of geopolitical or financial issues. Now, I think it's probably more a short-term issue, meaning it could be a couple of days, it could be a day, it could be a week, but the market seems to have gotten more comfortable with volatility, and therefore deals are still getting done, notwithstanding the volatile environment. So it's easier to come to market now than it was maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, but there are still open windows and closed windows.
And what types of deals are getting done right now? What's the profile of a successful issuer right now?
So the profile in the equity capital markets, in general, I would say and remember, we have to divide the equity capital markets essentially maybe into two. One are follow-on offerings and one are IPOs. Follow-on offerings are companies that are already public. People know who they are. Obviously, at this point, presumably the company is doing well. They need more capital. Potentially, some of their stockholders want to get out, but they've got a history of reporting. They've got a history of trading. Those companies are doing well. They're still being able to come to the market. Although we've seen in 2026, volumes are down a bit in the follow-on market, but the follow-on market is by far the larger of the two markets compared to the IPO market. The IPO market in 2025 came back. It was a very busy year. It was led by tech companies, by pharmaceutical companies. And other than a few companies, I'd say one of the things that we're seeing, certainly in the IPO market, is a shift away from startup companies with a great idea, but no revenue and no profitability, to looking at companies that are farther down the road of their evolution, where they've got a product, they've got revenues, they've either got profits or they've got a significant path towards profitability in the short term. So for example, interesting, we haven't seen the AI companies, the big OpenAI, Anthropic, come to market yet, although there's talk that they'll come in 2026 and we're all excited about that. But you've had companies that are in adjacent areas. So for example, a Databricks, companies that are in the AI infrastructure where they are profitable, they are making money, even if they're spending a lot of money to build things. Same thing on the biochem and the pharmaceutical industry. We're not looking at companies that have one product at maybe an early stage. We're talking about companies that have multiple products that are farther down the road towards getting FDA approval. And so either have some licensing revenue already, or certainly are farther down the road towards revenue and profitability. So they're more mature companies, and those companies are doing much better. Interestingly, while the majority of the companies that are going public these days seem to be in the tech area, the pharmaceutical area, the healthcare industry, we're still seeing a lot of financial institutions coming public, and just basic kind of, you know, Bob's retail kinds of companies, construction companies, retail companies, the folks that make widgets. So even non-sexy companies that are profitable, that have growth paths, are being able to come public and doing quite well.
And are those businesses that are working well right now, are they just in the planning stage? Are they getting ready to execute an issuance regardless of the volatility, or where do they stand in their planning?
Companies that are already public doing a follow-on can come to market fairly quickly. And that's really a question of when do they need the capital and what are they using it for? For example, growing their business, refinancing debt. Companies going through the IPO process, it's a much longer process. And some people would say it's anywhere from a 6 to 9 to 12 month process. So we have a number of companies that are in various stages that we're working with now that are in various stages of the IPO process, from getting their house in order, just cleaning up their balance sheet, cleaning up their due diligence, looking at what's going on at the company, to companies that have already engaged investment bankers who've already started drafting their SEC filings, to companies that have already confidentially submitted at the SEC and are just waiting for the SEC to clear them and for the market to be ready for them. So lots of companies, first quarter had very good results. Obviously, the conflict in the Middle East right now is a little bit later in the first quarter, but the beginning of the first quarter, very strong. Part of that was holdover from last year, where a number of companies had to push off their IPOs because the SEC had closed down for a period of time. So they were waiting until the beginning of the year. And then a lot of companies then go into blackout towards the middle, towards end of February, as they're waiting for their earnings from the prior year to be done, their financial statements to be audited and ready to go. So I think we'll probably see a pickup in IPO activity in April and certainly early May.
And you mentioned those mega IPOs that are in the pipeline. Do you expect those to actually get out this year? And if so, what's sort of the timetable on that? And how many do you think we might see?
Well, we're certainly hoping that we're going to see a couple of those mega IPOs. The companies that are rumored to be coming public this year are, for example, SpaceX, that, as I think you know, just merged with XAI or is in the process of merging with XAI. So that would be absolutely huge. Right now, the estimated valuation will be somewhere about $1.2 trillion. Would make it the largest company to ever go public. OpenAI, Anthropic, companies like that, we would see, you know, huge companies that are going public with, you know, over $500 billion valuation. So those are the big ones. So certainly SpaceX has been rumored to be going public. There have been reports that they've hired lawyers and that they've already appointed their underwriters. So I would expect that we're going to see them this year. If SpaceX can come out, I think that we're probably going to see a couple of others. Success builds on success. And so if you have one or two big companies come and perform well in the aftermarket, I think that's going to be a good indication that other companies are going to follow them.
Is there enough investor demand to capitalize all these companies?
That's a great question. I was talking to somebody about that last year on a program, that if you had a SpaceX come out with a $20, $30, $40 billion IPO, is that just going to, you know, sock up all the free cash out there? And I don't believe it is. First of all, it's a huge market out there. The mutual funds in the US have trillions of dollars of assets. So I think there are assets out there. I think the other thing, though, that we're going to see is there are certain companies, a SpaceX, XAI, an OpenAI, an Anthropic. These are going to be the kinds of companies that investors are going to want to own a piece of because, frankly, they're sexy. Investment managers are going to want to have them in their portfolio because these are companies that everybody's looking at. So you're going to be a little hard-pressed to be an investment manager and have some of your investors call up and say, gee, why aren't you in that? So I think you're going to have everybody wanting a little piece of it. So one way or another, they're going to make room in their portfolio to buy some of this. And then I think there's also going to be a huge retail demand. Again, I've mentioned three of the most commonly named companies that are going to go public and everybody knows them, but there'll be other companies not as well known in the retail space, but in the institutional space that I think will do well.
And how about these companies that aren't raising, you know, tens of billions of dollars, but maybe they're only raising 100 million to 500 million in their IPO? Is there room for those types of companies in this market?
Absolutely. The majority of companies going public are not the mega deals. Most of the companies that go public are actually much smaller. It's interesting that you mentioned smaller IPOs in the $100 million to $500 million range. I remember when I first started practicing, I was doing a deal, I think it was about $50 million. It was a loan. And I thought it was a huge amount of money as a 22-year-old in law school. And the partner said, oh, gee, that's not an awful lot of money. And I kind of thought to myself, wow, I'm definitely getting into a different world. So now when we're in the world of people talking about $100 million IPO not being so big, or even $500 million. But yeah, I think there's absolutely room for that. A couple of reasons. Number one, I think we'll see these as companies that are established, that have profitability, that have good growth prospects. And so I think that's going to be what the market is looking for. The interesting questions we're going to run into, for example, on an OpenAI or an Anthropic, are how do you value those companies? Is it a multiple of earnings? Do they have the earnings? Remember, they're going to be spending, you know, billions of dollars still building their product out. So there aren't really good comps for some of these companies. SpaceX, it'll be, you know, it's sui generis. It's the only space exploration company that's going to be public. So it's going to be hard to value those. So I think you're going to have a lot of investors looking at, you know, brick and mortar companies that are profitable, understanding them. They're going to be easier to value. And so I think that's going to be very helpful. And also, frankly, a smaller company probably has bigger growth prospects where it can do acquisitions, it can grow. Obviously, larger companies, the larger you are, the harder it is to really do a transformative transaction. So I think smaller companies will still have an awful lot of visibility in the IPO market.
Great. OpenAI and Anthropic are obviously leading this AI revolution. Can you talk about how that's impacting the software sector and where they can go from here?
Sure. A little bit outside of my wheelhouse as a lawyer, but really just enthralled with the whole AI marketplace and listen to a lot of podcasts and really follow it carefully. So it's a great question. So when Anthropic the other day issued their new Claude Cowork, where they said that they could do all sorts of things. That same day, you had a number of SaaS providers drop 15-20% because a lot of what Claude Cowork could do were things that other companies were already doing, and they had their software was doing that, and Claude was either free or relatively inexpensive and could do the same thing. And rather than having to pay a per seat license to a Salesforce or something like that, you could use Claude Cowork to do that. So a number of companies really went down as some of these AI companies are just releasing new features, not charging for them, but they're able to do the things that other companies have been doing. So from that standpoint, yes, AI seems to be affecting certainly the valuations for some of these companies. I think that's a short-term issue as the market figures out, will people use Claude Cowork, for example, to replace a Salesforce, to replace some other SaaS provider that they've been using? On the other hand, I think you've got folks, and again, I'm sorry to pick on Salesforce, but Salesforce has a huge embedded number of people that use it, understand it, benefit by it. So I think there are an awful lot of companies that just have been around that have products that people understand and that are integrated into a number of their other systems. So I don't think they're necessarily going to go away that quickly. I think it'll be interesting to see how they work with some of the AI companies and whether companies in general will be relying on AI to replace all these other things, or look, Microsoft Word, I've been using it for 25 years. It works really well. Do I really need an AI to do this? Is AI going to replace certain other things? Am I going to be comfortable with AI accessing my calendar, accessing my email, and being able to do things on an agentic basis? So I wouldn't write off all the SaaS companies quite yet, but I think certainly some of them may have to pivot in terms of how they're working and how they're interacting with AI.
Another trend we've seen in the past 12 months is a resurgence of SPACs. Especially this year, it seems like there's been an acceleration in SPAC IPOs. So there's a lot of blank check vehicles out there looking for targets. I don't think we've seen quite as many de-SPACs where they've actually completed mergers. But can you talk about how these blank check companies are taking on a more active role in the markets these days?
So special purpose acquisition companies, or SPACs, have been around for quite some time. In the probably the 20 to 22 timeframe, they were extremely active and accounted for a huge percentage of the IPO market. A SPAC essentially is a special purpose company that goes public. It raises, we'll use $100 million as an example. That $100 million sits in a trust account earning interest. The management of the SPAC then goes out to look for a private company, typically to merge with, and then the SPAC, the private company, then becomes a public company by merging with the SPAC. The private company shareholders get stock in the SPAC. The SPAC stockholders get to vote on the transaction, and as part of that, also get to decide whether they want to keep their stock in the SPAC, now public or de-SPAC'd company, whether they want to put their stock back to the SPAC and get their original investment back plus interest. And then they also get to keep warrants that are typically stapled to that stock. And then the SPAC sponsors also get to keep a piece of the public company. So that's how a SPAC works. So it's another way for a private company to go public, and often is a way for a private company to go public in a choppy market. Now, in the 21-22 timeframe, we saw an awful lot of SPACs go public. Some of them were sponsored by celebrities, sports figures. Everybody and their mother wanted to get in on the SPAC craze. And SPACs typically have a limited life, typically a two-year time frame. And if they don't find a private company to merge with, they typically then liquidate, and the original money goes back to the original investors, to the public investors. So an awful lot of companies, there was a lot of competition for companies to take public. A lot of the SPACs in the 2021-22 timeframe didn't find anybody and wound up liquidating. One of the things that I think has come out of that are a real winnowing out of the folks that shouldn't have been doing SPACs. So when you have sports figures, when you have online celebrities, when you have folks like that sponsoring SPACs, they probably should be doing M&A deals. So one of the nice things is we've seen a lot of them leave the marketplace. There were also companies that were being taken public with huge valuations that weren't backed up by revenue or profitability. So a lot of that has also shaken out of the marketplace. And what we've seen is we now have serial SPAC sponsors. So you have some SPAC sponsors that are on their 8th, 9th, 10th SPAC. So the nice thing is the market recognizes the value that they bring. They know what they're doing. they are better able to find the gems to take public, the companies that other people may not have seen. They know how to get those deals done. And just as importantly, they know how to set them up for success as a public company. So what we've seen is a shakeout of the folks that probably should have never been in the SPAC market or that aren't as familiar with the SPAC market. And it's a little bit like a flight to quality. So we're seeing more and more of that coming back. So as the IPO in the SPAC IPO market continues to expand, we're going to also start seeing more de-SPACs. But the de-SPACs have been busy. And frankly, on both sides, we've been thrilled to be part of that.
Another busy area of the market has been convertible bonds. What is it about these convertible debt instruments and preferred stock options that are so appealing to companies in this environment?
Great question. Converts, 2025 was a record year. In the US, there were over $120 billion of converts. That was up from $86 billion. This year to date, we've already had close to $15 billion. So we're on pace to be almost as active as 2025. So the market has definitely been very hot. What's driving the market right now are a couple of things. Number one are refinancings. So a number of converts were issued in the 2021 timeframe, and convertible securities tend to have a relatively short time frame, so a 5 to 7 year maturity. So a number of those converts that were issued 3, 4, 5 years ago are beginning to mature, and companies have to look at either paying them off. If they're in the money, they may convert, or they need to refinance them. Number one is the interest rate environment. We still have a relatively high interest rate environment. And so for a company that would consider issuing convertible bonds versus high yield, it's looking at high yield interest rates of 8 to 10%, whereas the interest rate on a convert is probably 1 to 2% because investors are also getting the upside, potential upside on the stock. So they're willing to take a lower coupon. So for companies that need the capital but don't want to have to pay the interest, they're very favorable. The equity market volatility is also really good because remember, a convert has an embedded option in it. And so the more volatility, the more valuable that option can be. So that's a really helpful thing right now. So we see that as a couple of the drivers of the marketplace right now. Interestingly, the other thing that we're seeing is the convert market is a lot of the growth has been in the tech and the AI space. Last year, I believe it was, you know, something like 20% of all the converts that were done were in the tech and the AI space. So that is driving some of that. The other thing that we're seeing is that it used to be that smaller companies were doing converts. Now we're seeing massive size deals. So last year we saw 12 deals that exceeded $1 billion. So that's a pretty big, you know, size deal for a convert. And so that's, again, that's driving the overall numbers in the convert market.
Those are really valuable insights. Thank you so much for sharing. And now that we're closing the first quarter here and moving into the second quarter, maybe just with some closing thoughts on what you're telling your clients as we move into this next period.
What we're telling our clients is that the markets will be available. There may be windows where the markets are closed. And so what's going to be really important is to be nimble, to be cautious, and to be patient. So by that, I mean, figure out what your needs are as early as you can. So clearly, if you're refinancing debt, you know when it's going to come due. Don't wait till the last minute to refinance the debt. If you have capital needs, again, figure out when you're going to need that capital and start planning as early as possible. Be nimble, meaning look at different ways to do that financing. It may very well be that you are looking to do it with equity, whether it's a convert, whether it's equity, whether it's a pipe, but have a couple of different arrows in your quiver so that if the market for one isn't right there, you're going to be able to look at something else, maybe put in a line of credit so that you can borrow against it and then refinance it a little bit later. So be nimble, look at the different options to finance, and then be prepared. As I said, start preparing as early as you can. Get your documents in place as early as you can so that when there is that window of opportunity, you're able to tap it, and then be patient because it may very well be that you're a great company, you're ready to go to the market, but the market isn't there today, but it may be there tomorrow and it may be there the day after. Just frankly, we had a transaction. It was a debt capital markets deal that went on Monday for a AA+ issuer. So that's an issuer, financial institution, not really affected by some of the geopolitical things going on. They should have been able to finance, no problem. And we wound up doing go, no go calls for about 3 or 4 days in a row before the market was there. And again, be patient. The window will be there. It may not be there today. It may not be there tomorrow. It may be next week. It may be in 2 weeks, but the windows have been opening. And so be prepared, be patient, and be nimble.
That sounds like some sage advice. Thanks for joining us, Eddie. I really appreciate you coming on.
That was Merger Markets' Troy Hooper speaking to Eddie Best, a partner at Wilkie. And just to point out that this episode was recorded on Wednesday, the 25th of March. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Merger Markets. For more information about the conversation, have a look at our show notes. Please follow and subscribe on your favourite podcast app and join us again next time.